Welcome to the All About Alts podcast, where we explore the world of alternative investing to help you find financial independence. Join our host, Newview Trust's president, Jason DeBono, as he covers a variety of topics with different guest speakers to discuss tax and alternative investing strategies. It is never too late to start taking control of your financial future, and we are so excited for you to be joining us for this opportunity to hear from some of the best in the business. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the All About Alts podcast. I am your host, Jason DeBono, joined by Justin Mitchell today, founder and CEO of RWA Group, which oversees a 506B mortgage REIT. So a lot going on. How are you, Justin?
I'm well, Jason. Thank you for having me.
And we're going to talk about a mortgage REIT. I love today's topic because I think a lot of times we think of REITs as being the real estate side, right? You know, is this an apartment REIT? Is this an office space? Is this industrial warehouse? But actually, we're going to talk about kind of the lending side of things and certainly a hot topic as it relates to interest rates and everything going on there. So a lot to unpack today. Before we do that, I want to talk just a little bit and maybe give our listeners a little bit of background. You know, Justin, I've gotten to know you and your background, and it's absolutely incredible. Right? You're started as an analyst at Countrywide. And for those listening today, that are like, I've never heard of Countrywide, it's probably because Countrywide no longer exists. They were one of the groups that was merged and taken over during kind of the Great Recession back in 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010, and we can talk about that. But let's start there. You know, you're coming out of school, you go to Countrywide, you're pumped, life is good. What was that experience like? And maybe just kind of cutting your teeth, and then also what that recession looked like.
Yeah, it's actually pretty wild. 2 weeks into the job, the market crashed. And so, talk about, having to learn quick on your feet. And so pivoting was interesting over there. So started that, we kind of made it through some of the tailwinds or the headwinds with Countrywide. And then we went to, Bank of America came in and absorbed us. But it was great. I learned a ton about the market, the resilience of the team, and a lot more so on credit and how people were kind of gaming the system and taking advantage of the environment where it was just so much liquidity, which is being pumped to everybody. So it was a great tool for me to learn, and it really helped kind of go to the next phase of my career, which is where I started in private credit at Genesis Capital.
Well, you talk about adversity, right? I mean, I knew that you were part of Countrywide and went through that. I didn't know it was 2 weeks in.
Yeah.
The dust hasn't even settled. The ink on your name tag wasn't fully dry.
Yeah, it was interesting to see it from a bustling place at the corporate headquarters to just a ghost town within weeks. It was really fascinating, but very quick moving pace just because of the environment of activity. The bank at that time was just facing so many repurchase demands from all these investors who had purchased mortgage-backed securities. And it was our job at that time to now defend the bank from these repurchases. And if you can imagine, it wasn't just, hundreds, it was hundreds of thousands at a time. And the team grew from about 20 people to 7,000 over the course of 4 years. So it was a really big division of the company at the time. And It was interesting. It was very wild. But I think I want to say about a year ago, they just finalized their last litigation with, an investor with Ambec. And that's the books, which so it's incredible, 12 years later. So interesting times for sure.
Well, there was a lot to learn, through 2007. And I think if, maybe speaking a little bit for you, while you probably knowing what you know now may have may actually have gone back and done the same thing, because that experience and kind of seeing things unravel and how they got there. I'm a big believer when I do real estate deals or investment deals, it's like, tell me about your worst deal. Tell me when everything went wrong, because, I won't say it's easy when things are going right. Investing is hard. Managing people's money is hard. So I admire people that do it. But I have a little special admiration for the ones that have been through tough times and, came out of that. So what did you learn through that, in 2008, 2009, 2010? And then we'll kind of talk a little bit about, as you moved on in your career and where you've gone.
I really focused, was really into the credit side of the business. And it's fascinating to see the psychological the clients that were taking advantage of these banks that were just getting loans. I mean, I saw loans that were made to people in prison. I saw, you know, all the things you can imagine that it was such easy credit at the time. And you can see how clients kind of twist and turn just to get that credit, pull that credit lever. And honestly, how surprising it was that all these big institutions were just so asleep at the wheel when it comes to underwriting. And that's something that really kind of holds true and fast, that look out for these little things that, you know, don't just be asleep at the wheel, right? And so many people did just because they thought the market was just going to rip. And I think that's more than anything that I took back from that. So,
yeah, what an amazing time. I'm sure you've seen The Big Short, for those listening.
Yeah,
you know, that haven't. I can't recommend that enough. It's a great movie. I'm here in Orlando, and the movie was predominantly filmed here. And you know, it was just, you know, I think for those of us that lived through it, and I started, you know, my career in 2005 after school. And so, you know, I was in a position, now we're on the custody side. And so it's a little bit different for us. We didn't have all the pain per se, but you still saw it. I mean, we watched our clients go through it, and it was an amazing time. And so, you know, you eventually left and ended up at Genesis Capital, employee number 5. This company grows and ends up getting acquired by Goldman Sachs, right? You know, that's a whole nother story in and of itself, right? Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was really interesting. We started off as an auction house to sell for these banks, the foreclosures that came out of these, you know, these troubled institutions. And so it was wildly successful. But what we saw was interesting was our clients who were buying on the platform really struggled to accumulate the amount of properties that they wanted to. So we had bigger institutions that were buying off the platform. I mean, we were selling hundreds, you know, a day, you know, thousands. And when we noticed that, we said, well, why don't we start, you know, lending to these clients, right? These are great assets. They're buying them below replacement cost. And we can earn a great yield, and it's secured by a first trustee. And so we said, you know, there's money out there from, like, they call it hard money, where that institution doesn't look at the borrower, they just look at the asset. And we said, well, why don't we create something where we can look at both the asset and the borrower and create something more along the lines of private money? And we did. And then, you know, Oak Tree Capital came in and backed us, and we institutionalized the hard money space. Because as you may or may not know, hard money is very fractionalized. You know, you got a guy with $5 million, $10 million, and there's just, you know, thousands of these individuals across the country, and, you know, it's sporadic. And so we took advantage of a market niche or market need, and we ran with it. And I think we did about 4 years, you know, many billions, and then we ended up selling it to Goldman Sachs.
Well, what a, you know, and I think what I learned through that process and you know, kind of the recession was, yeah, a lot of new industries were created, a lot of new opportunities. And, you know, I won't pretend to predict where we are in whatever inning of whatever, cycle we're in, because I think we're all scratching our heads quite a bit that, you know, between COVID and interest rate hikes that didn't bring this, you know, us down crumbling to our knees. And some of that's a little PTSD for those of us that lived through 2007. We're just assuming that, you know, this is it. That's it. This is the time. And the economy's been incredibly resilient through that process. And I think one thing that, you know, I've gotten to really kind of get a better insight in through some of the banks that I know well, you know, and is that they're not suggesting that if things go bad, there can't be defaults. And they're not suggesting, but the underwriting process today is just so different than it was back in 2005 and 6. And, you know, to your point, I mean, you got someone in prison with no income, you know, getting a loan and buying whatever they want. Yet, you know, today you're not buying a house with no money down in most cases. You're not buying a house without good credit. You're not buying a house unless it's got some equity, 10, 20% down. So much different lending environment. Talk a little bit about that, because I think that maybe parlays a little bit into how you got into the REIT business.
Yeah, completely different environment. The credit standards are much different than they were in 07, mentioned very well. And I think that's been a great kind of area because, as you know, as things have increased in price, but the underwriting standards have been very, very strong. So I think that's a great thing to kind of hone in on because, you know, before the froth was always just built by just this endless cash. Everybody was getting loans. Right. That's not the case right now, right? It's very difficult to get a loan, to your point. And I think that's an interesting kind of thing to bring into this discussion, because, you know, mortgage underwriting is an important part of keeping this kind of the foundation of the residential strong, right? And also the lack of supply, I think, is another thing as well. But I mean, that's one thing that I really carried over into this private world is, you know, tight credit standards. And I think if you were to look at my track record from you know, the billions of dollars that we've lent out, we've had a resilient track record in terms of low defaults, low foreclosures. So it's been an incredible run just by taking those that mindset of, hey, credit is everything, and applying that to what I do. And it's been a good resilient run so far by, you know, taking that as one of the forefront things that we factor in when making a loan.
Well, you know, and sometimes that experience, right? You know, at the time in 2007, you're probably wondering, what the heck? Why am I going through this? I thought the world was going to be simple when I got out of school, and I was going to, you know, join this big firm, and all of a sudden, you know, the world changed. But it's given you, you know, not only a philosophical understanding, but a real world understanding of what happens if. And I think in the credit world, the what happens if is, right, the question of the day. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, the resiliency of the market as a whole. You know, we saw interest rates, you know, shoot through the roof, unprecedented, right? 400 or 500 basis point rise in, you know, 22 months or something absurd, maybe even less. So through that process, you know, I think everybody, right, whether it was the talking heads, the pundits, or just those of us that are, you know, investors, we're going, all right, that's got to be it. You know, if the market didn't crash at 4%, it's going to crash at 5%. If it didn't crash at 5%, it's going to crash at 6%. If it didn't crash at 6%, it's going to crash at 7%. And you're like, well, what the hell? I mean, this is unbelievable. And I think people underestimate supply, you know, and just how little of that is. What did you see through that? Maybe not even so much from a REIT standpoint. We can talk about that certainly, but just, you know, through your eyes, you know, what were you thinking as rates went up, and what did you kind of see or foresee would happen through that process?
Yeah. So luckily during that time, my previous group I was with, we weren't writing many long duration loans. The beauty of our product is that it's so short in nature that it gives you the ability to kind of be nimble, kind of enter and exit points of the market. So we'll make a loan for 9 to 12 months. On average, those loans will pay off anywhere from maybe, you know, 5 to 7 months. So they're very quick in duration, which makes it great as, you know, an analyst watching the market. So we didn't have too much, any volatility in the portfolio, but I saw it going much higher. I was honestly a contrarian where I thought inflation is going to be much stickier, rates aren't coming down, and we prepped that way, and we did pretty well going through that time, actually much better than I think people realized. And I think we just knew where the market was going, that it wasn't going to stop at 4 or 5. But the lack of supply was really, in my opinion, the biggest factor, right? Because with no supply, people need homes. And especially where we're at, California, we're undersupplied. The whole country is undersupplied. So it's propping up values for sure. But I mean, consumer credit has been, I mean, so somewhat pretty resilient. There's a lot of money in the system that has yet to be flushed out. And, you know, I think we're still kind of in that mid-level cycle where, you know, I think we got some time before it gets flushed out. But again, if you can just kind of stay true to your credit standards and understand that with, you know, there's some interest rate volatility. I still think there's room to go up with this interest rate hike. People think it's coming down. I'm like, there's absolutely, I don't see it happening, just because where we're at, the economy's, you know, on paper, it's pumping well. And why would they pull back rates if we're running too hot still? So it's interesting, but I take that that view in mind that I think residential at all the asset classes is gonna do quite well until supply comes, like there's an imbalance, and I just don't see that happening for the period, right? COVID, lack of supply, COVID really pumped the brakes on bringing that supply to market. Interest rates, right? As you know, people stop building homes, people stop investing in homes, and so kind of see where the market went. So you have almost a period of 12 to 24 months where just production has really slowed down. And I don't know how we ever catch up to, you know, where we need to be. I really don't, just given, you know, it's tough to build in some of these municipalities. It's a lot of red tape, you know, and, but some of these red states are a little bit better, but these blue states, man, it's, you probably hear, but it's tough to get a home over the finish line, you know, call it 36 to 48 months. It's a long time. So I think as long as the supply imbalance is there, it's going to keep this asset class resilient. And I think as long as the credit standards are there, we're going to be just fine, right? I think it's more so we're going to feel it more on the multifamily where there was some duration kind of, you know, imbalance, right? Making long dated rates at 3-4% when those now need to be priced closer to 6 to maybe, you know, 7-8%. So, but those will slowly come off the books. There's a lot of money in the system from these private equities. This asset class has just ballooned since the GFC crisis. As you know, the Blackstones, the Brookfields, they've got so much money and they are looking to deploy it. So I think as this distress kind of rears its head, people are pruning that distress. It's not going to be like it used to be where it just, boom, we got blown up. Unless a black swan event, where I just don't see it happening with real estate, or sorry, residential real estate. But, you know, commercial is something to watch. It's been front and center. So, yeah, but again, you're seeing that slowly kind of prune out of the system versus just a black swan event.
Well, I think, you know, our thought process is very similar. You know, I think, you know, rates went up and then it's like there's this assumption that, you know, what goes up must come down. And, you know, I think certainly you've got an election year. There's a lot going on there. You've got, you know, pretty polarizing candidates in a lot of ways, pun intended, you know, in on both sides of the aisle. And certainly the outcomes could or likely would be drastically different. You know, depending on what that looks like. But if you look at the real estate market as a whole, you know, I think your point about commercial and some of the multifamily, yeah, I mean, there's certainly some, you know, potential cracks in the armor that could, you know, be a little bit more important or material to the economy. But, you know, barring a major issue with people's paychecks, people can still afford homes. And as much as we think they're expensive, they're only as expensive as the ability for someone to buy one is. And so, you know, if you got low supply and you've got the ability for people to still get capital and for still to make investments, whether it be for primary residence or true investment, you know, it is really hard to catch up. I saw an article, I don't know if you caught it in the Wall Street Journal, it was a couple months ago now, but it was, I think it was the top 50 metros or markets in the U.S., and there was only 5, so less than or right at 10%, that had pre-pandemic inventory levels. Wow. So, you know, we haven't even replaced the inventory that existed in 2019. We were only 5 places were above that line. And so, you know, when you start to look at that and you talk about supply, you know, yeah, I mean, you can add supply and certainly there's builders that are, you know, doing that and their starts and all of that. But if you look, we're still producing less starts in real estate than we did back in 2005. So we're not, you know, and the population has only grown. So, you know, certainly market, you know, geographics of markets will have some variance. But yeah, I mean, I don't think either of us are prepared to say it will or won't happen in either direction. But I think it is pretty hard to look and go, some black swan event does have to happen to see a real catastrophic impact on the real estate market, which is great, right? And I think what we're seeing now, and I'd imagine, Justin, in your world, the thing that I love is, you know, because real estate has slowed down, I mean, ask anybody in real estate, residential, it has slowed down. The number of loan applications has slowed. The number of purchases has slowed. That's not a bad thing. It means that the market goes back to normalized opportunities. And so, you know, rather than this kind of feverish, you know, growth where everything's selling, which I think is exciting, it's not a good, healthy market in whether that's public equities, real estate. So what have you seen there? And maybe close out the first half with this one.
Yeah, I think it's so fascinating. It's just, I'm a big believer in kind of feeling out the pulse of the market. And so what's made me so successful is going into these new markets that we lend in, right? Spending time with people, whether it's going to dinner and talking with people, just investors in the area, all walks of life. But I find it fascinating that during those periods, you know, people were flipping homes so quickly that the minute that they weren't able to sell a property within 48 hours, it was like, what's going on? I'm like, well, do you understand that the normal process to sell a property is like, you know, you put it on the market and you're waiting at least maybe 30 days to get some sort of traction. And it may take another 30 to 60 days to sell it. So like, you know, days on market is normal to be anywhere from, you know, 60 to 120 days. That's very normal. And I think the psychology of these investors and consumers is like, it's kind of flipped, right? But now it is good. I think this is really healthy for the economy, for things to slow down, because you can't, that's not healthy, right? For things to just be sprinting like that. And so I think we're seeing definitely now that it's definitely a buyer's market. That doesn't mean that people are going in and, you know, getting 20% off, but for the right projects, what I'm seeing is something that's not finished where it's turnkey, you're probably not going to get a full pop on that dollar. I'm seeing that if it is turnkey, people are getting multiple asks still, because again, there's just nothing on the market. And if you live in a nice area, there's going to be people that are, if a desirable, kind of, you're going to make offers on properties. But on the flip side of that, we're seeing that when someone has a distressed property, they can't just put it on the market and just get top dollar for it. It's sitting, and they're having to realize that, hey, I need to sell this at, you know, at a little bit of a discount to move the property. So I think the consumer psyche is definitely turning. I think everybody's slowing down. I think it's been really good because it's really weeded out a lot of speculation, right? You got the HGTVs, that those are not our clients that we lend to, but you have a lot of people that think it's really sexy to flip a home. And I think that does drive speculation. And I think a lot of these players have been removed out of the sideline because they're saying, well, this is wild. Interest rates, it's not, property's not moving. And so I think it's really healthy for the economy based on, you know, the slowdown. But, you know, listen, the clients that I lend to are very different in that nature. They're more institutional, meaning, you know, I have clients that flip minimum 15 properties a year. I've had clients that do 400, 500 properties a year. So very different breed of clients. But those clients don't really stop in the down market, which I thought is so resilient. They understand how to buy going down because you can still make money doing this. Everybody can make money going up. But it does slow down, right? I have a client that I've done, you were just speaking with the other day, she's done over, you know, $130 million in loan. I've given her $130 million in loans. And I look at her track record and I'm like, oh, you've been pretty quiet over the last couple of years. She's like, yeah, I'm waiting for the right entry, right? And so she's like, I have plenty of projects that I need to kind of work out and bigger projects. So I'm just waiting for the right entry. And she found a couple projects and they're really, you know, really good prices. So it's interesting for sure. But I think it, as a whole, it's a good thing for the entire market, for things to slow down and kind of find its footing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, nothing's good at either end of the pendulum. You know, it's somewhere in the middle and it's okay to have some variance. It's just big swings in either direction. Usually, are never good. And I have to say, you know, I don't know. It's a big ship to steer, you know, the economy. And I certainly don't envy anyone, you know, that's even in those meetings that has to talk about what they do. But I have to say, I don't give the government a lot of credit very often. But I think the Fed is at least what they did. They didn't just, you know, take the pendulum that was here and push it as hard as they could and then not worry about it hitting the other side. I think it's kind of slowly getting back to center. And hopefully if we can, you know, kind of manage this balancing act and we don't have that black swan type event, or we don't see some catastrophic, you know, impact to the marketplace. We may just be able to kind of stay at equilibrium. And that is, to your point, absolutely good for all involved. We're gonna throw you on the hot seat. Quirky questions of the day. I hope you're ready. One of my favorite parts of the show, Miss Amy, we're going middle envelope today. Thank you. Thank you guys. Keep submitting quirky questions of the day. You can send them to allaboutalts@newviewtrust.com. There we go. Are you ready?
I hope so.
This is an interesting one because as a guy in Southern California getting, this is a weather related one. I swear Southern California has the best weather in the U.S. So, if you had to choose hot weather or cold weather, I think you get the best of both now.
I do hot all day long. I just don't do well in cold. Although I do like skiing, I can't last too long in the cold. I grew up on the lakes and, you know, water skiing and doing that. So I much rather prefer a warmer climate.
I'm with you. As a Florida guy, I have to agree with you. All right, question number two. If you could live in any fictional universe, which one would you choose?
I'm a big sci-fi geek, so I just watched the movie Dune. That was pretty good. So I'll say, there you go, the Dune fictional world. Does that work?
This is the quirky questions. There's no right or wrong answers. But now I got to go watch that movie so I get a better handle on where you're headed. If you could bring one extinct animal back to life, which one you bring it back?
Got to go with the dinosaur. Everybody wants to see kind of these beautiful creatures in person. So I got to say dinosaurs.
All right. Well, we'll go bonus question. If you had to pick which dinosaur, where are you going?
Tyrannosaurus Rex, the king.
Oh, man. Okay.
Man, yeah.
So you want some real excitement in this world. You think the world's gone mad in a lot of ways today. Wait till there's a T-Rex just running down the street. Right. So I love it.
A little bit of cleanup. So there you go.
I love it. Well, it certainly would probably make good headway for the real estate market and fix and flips, although I'm not sure how you fix a property that a T-Rex has ran through, but I suppose someone will figure it out.
That's right.
Awesome. Well, thank you. Thanks for hopping on the hot seat. We'll let you off and let's turn the tables a little bit. You know, we talked a lot about kind of how you got here and the economic scenarios that you've been through and even a little bit about where we are today. Let's talk about a mortgage REIT. You know, I think it's something that we've really never talked about. We talk about private lending. Most of our listeners know that's very near and dear to my heart. I've done a good handful of private loans, you know, as a strategy and an investment, but I'm doing it in a small scale, right? You know, one here, one there. You're doing it in a large scale. Maybe just give us a quick primer. You know, what is a mortgage REIT? You know, at a high level, and why did you end up there?
Yeah, so the mortgage REIT is essentially a taxable kind of strategy where it allows us to acquire and originate loans secured by these short duration, you know, non-owner occupied, which is a very important thing, right? These are non-owner occupied properties, business purpose loans, right? That we make to LLCs and corporations. And we accumulate those and we put those into the REIT. And by putting those in the REIT, we produce what's called good REIT income. And that's that provides a taxable strategy to the investor, right? The QBI deduction, which is nice on income. So the reason for that, the origin for this was all my career, this has just been a predominantly dominated business by Wall Street, right? Wall Street just loves the space. It moves fast, the money turns. And it's a great way to park money and, you know, almost like a high yield savings account for these guys. That's how pretty much a lot of these bigger institutions view this asset class. And it's secured by, you know, first trust deed and some great properties. So with my previous shop, it was interesting because we worked with a lot of hedge funds and it was a deep pool of capital. And, you know, when the market does this, these hedge funds go from being conservative to now they go risk on because they want to now acquire more distress, or they want to focus away from, they want to pivot their strategy. And that caused us to be, you know, a lot of volatility in the business model. We performed exceptionally well, but we had to kind of bob and flow with what the Wall Street wanted. And I always thought to myself, I said, you know, nobody's doing a REIT with this in this industry. It's so fractionalized or it's dominated by Wall Street. There isn't anybody providing a REIT. And so one of my great, I think, mentors and, you know, they manage some of my money, Morton Capital. They love alts and investing in through these alts. They just didn't have a product that was residential focused. And so I started saying, well, why don't I'm an investor. I would love to be in this asset class, but in a REIT, right? REIT, you get the diversification, right? You know, hundreds and thousands of assets accumulated into the REIT, all generating high yield, and you get a taxable, you know, deduction at the end of the day. So I thought to myself, this is a great product that I would want. My partners would want. Why we should bring this to market? And that was really the origin of it, is to really bring this and try to democratize it to the accredited investor versus you just having to go straight to a KKR or Blackstone when they're going to just put that money back into my fund, right? So I wanted to really go straight to the private wealth, the RIA community, and provide direct access, and they can have direct access to me, not just, you know, a talking head or an assistant where they can never get through to the manager, right? And so I feel like my track record and my past what better time to do it than now? And so we put the read out there. It's live, and now it's approved by Fidelity, Schwab, and Millennial Trust, and we're getting on board with you guys. So we're excited, really hopefully we can democratize this asset class.
Well, you guys have certainly, you're not new to the game. I mean, I jotted down some numbers from our discussions, right? I mean, $7 billion of real estate transactions, $2.6 billion of loans originated, 4,500 loans. This is not a small, mom and pops, let's figure it out. Is there a loan here? I mean, these loans are transpiring every single day and in good markets, in bad markets, on upswings, on downswings. What are you seeing today? You've obviously got a tremendous amount of volume that you've placed. What's a little different today? Are you navigating that REIT differently?
Always. I think, listen, my background as an analyst above everything has made me a great kind of steward of just credit. And so I happen to be a little not bad with the biz dev as well. So what's different today is that I think we're at an interesting time where I think the market's at an all-time frothy high. And, I feel like people a little asleep at the wheel, but definitely volumes ticked down, right? So we have to look at, where do we think the market's going to be in 6 to 12 months? That's kind of how we always view the space. I love residential, but we're being cautious. So I think definitely our exit kind of loans where we target, LT kind of future value is definitely come down. Cost, what we're willing to extend to that borrower has definitely come down. Rates have increased, which is nice. So the risk-adjusted return has been really, I think, where we want it to be. But again, being very selective with who we work with, because we do see some stuff that we feel like might come on the horizon with some stress, and we want to be aligned with the best-in-class operators. I tell people this all the time: people pay you back, properties don't. And so when you align yourself with a great guarantor, you should technically be okay going through the down times, and obviously the up times make sense. But that's the origin of it all. But that's, again, seeing what we're seeing in the market, it's been resilient. And some of my clients who, maybe they're not flipping 25 homes this year, but they're doing 10, right? And that's perfectly fine. And I think you can't rush into the space. You have to be very, very patient and diligent.
Well, you highlighted something earlier that is kind of an interesting component of being in the private lending space, especially, when your focus is really, 9 to 12 months, typically paid off in 5 to 7, I think you mentioned. That's a real opportunity to, sell into every market. I think for someone that's buying a house today, if you're buying that house and you plan to rent it and own it for 5 years, you got a lot of runway ahead of you to figure out what the heck's going to happen. And 6 months is a lot shorter.
Yeah, and the capital revolves so quickly. You really can take a view of where are we going to be in 6 months, right? Because when this loan pays off in 4 months, again, this capital is just moving in. So you get to really see, okay, where do we think we're going to be in this kind of this cycle? Or we're going to be in, 6, 9, 12 months from now. And it, from a defensive standpoint, it's I think it's one of the best asset classes.
Well, let's maybe take that out, put your feet to the fire a bit. If you had to kind of look out at 12 months, and enter as we enter into 2025, which, almost seems silly just to even say, time's been moving so darn fast. But if you were to look out at 2025, what do you see on the horizon? I know we've talked a little bit about it already, but just maybe very deliberately, knowing what you know today without expecting you to have a crystal ball. Yeah. But what are you seeing? What are the signs? What are the leading indicators, lagging indicators that you think, are going to lead to whatever lies ahead in 2025? And then I'll throw the ultimate, bomb on top of that and really cloud this whole question, which is you got a political election in November of 24.
Yeah. I think 2025 is going to be the year that we're really going to see what we got ourselves into. I think, government spending is going to really pull back, and that's going to be a very interesting thing to watch, because I think there's a lot of money pumped into these programs that is, I think, propping up a lot of the economy. And so I think 2025 will definitely see a slowdown. What I always find so fascinating is that as I go out and meet with all these different families and RIAs, is that how much money is in the system, right? There's just so much money out there. But, you know, that money didn't accumulate that wealth for no reason. So they are cautious as well. And I think there have been a lot of people on the sidelines that are now coming back into the market, which I find very fascinating just because given, you know, where we're at. But I think 2025 is going to really kind of rear its head and kind of slow things down. I don't think it's going to be somewhat of a, you know, extreme landing, but I do think that we're going to find ourselves between somewhat of a soft and hard. And, you know, well, as long as we kind of stay diligent on our credit and stick to who we work with, I think we should navigate just fine. But yeah, I think commercial real estate is going to be in for a run. I think whoever is elected in the next term is going to have their work cut out for them for sure.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that latter point. I don't envy that seat either. There's a lot going on, and yeah, I think I appreciate your perspective because I think it's certainly rooted in probably as an analyst a lot more information than most people's opinions, and it is a broad prediction, and really they should be. Anyone that tells you they know what's going to happen in a year. Right. They're guessing, and eventually they'll be right. But
I've been saying this for so long. Is that how much more can the market keep ripping? You know, in terms of not just the general equities market, but real estate market. I have been just like I don't even say anything anymore because I remember it like I was yesterday with my CFO on his balcony talking about the market being in like 2017. I'm like, there's just no way it can't keep going. We are much different area than we were back in 17. So it's fascinating. So I try not to be so predictive on things because nobody has a crystal ball, right?
Well, and if we did, I think we'd all be too scared to look at it. I heard, and I don't know if maybe you can validate this, but it seems just doing the back of the napkin math, we're in a 16-year bull run, and the previous longest in the real estate market was 13. So, that's a pretty impressive eclipsing, and if you think about that in and of itself, just a normal bull run, is probably 5 to 7 years. The longest is 13. We're at 16, and somehow factor in that we survived both a pandemic and the, most unprecedented rate hike in history. And here we are sitting at 16 years. So, yeah, I think, whether the hammer drops or whether it's just a collective cool down that, gets us back to reality, it's hard not to think that something like that does lie ahead.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's something that I often think about. I don't try to get obsessive with it. I think, coming out of the GFC crisis, I really became obsessive with, what got us here and how do we avoid those mistakes going forward. And that kind of my underlying principles of how I look at the business, right? Can't predict everything and just got to make the best with what you got and be very smart and cautious, right? Not try to get caught up in all the FOMO that you might see in the market right now and just people just rushing back in. People are like, how are you doing in the market? I'm like, I'm not in the market. I'm in real estate and I'm just going to focus in this asset class and I'm not riding the FOMO wave.
Well, that's a whole nother world of, and it won't say craziness, but it is. It's unbelievable the returns. And I saw NVIDIA was up to almost 1,000, and people would have thought it was crazy at 500. But you also have a company that went from 10% margins the year before, to 50% margins and $30 billion of net profit. I mean, it's amazing what AI has done, and certainly that's propping up and fueling at least the current run in the market. And who knows what's next? I think that's the beauty of investing, right? Real estate, public equities. You just never quite know anymore. The game has changed a heck of a lot over the last 15, right. 20 years.
I agree. And listen, I'm a big believer in AI. I just think there's a lot of froth around it. Whereas like every company I meet is trying to add a little punchline of AI to it just to increase their brand or if they're raising money. But NVIDIA is a great example of a great company that will do quite well just because of the sheer demand that we need from, chips and computing power.
No, it's been amazing to watch. Well, Justin, I've absolutely enjoyed our discussion today. Thanks so much for being here. We will put all your contact info into the show notes so that if anyone wants to reach out, obviously, it doesn't take long to realize he's a wealth of knowledge. But I think what I love about he's accessible. So if you've got questions or comments or thoughts or just want to, chat about the mortgage world and the private lending space and what a mortgage REIT is, give Justin a call and hammer that out. before I let you go completely, season two is all about finishing up the show with our last question, which is, what's keeping you up at night?
I would say just what we just talked about, you know, what's on the horizon, right? Where are we going to be in the next, you know, 12, 24 months as a steward of, you know, money, my family's money, my in-laws, my parents, my friends and family. I want to be, you know, rightly aligned. And I think this market ahead is looking very interesting. And so I think that really keeps me up. But if you were to ask my wife would say probably nothing because I sleep so well. But I think if you were to ask me, yeah, I think it's just the market, you know, headwinds. Just, you know, where are we going to be in the next 12, 24 months? But I like what we're doing. I think it's not sexy, but it's preservation. And we hit, I always tell people, I'm the Tony Gwynn of baseball. We get on base, we hit singles. So, and if you can kind of ride that ship and compound it, it's a great outlook for the foreseeable future.
Love the Tony Gwynn reference. If you don't know Tony Gwynn stats, go look them up. Every time I see one, I'm like, no way, you know. It's unbelievable. What an amazing athlete and just statistical anomaly as it relates to baseball. So love wrapping the show up on that. Yep. Justin, thank you again. Great to have you here. Thanks for tuning in today. We've got an incredible slate in season two. Coming up ahead, please be sure to hit the like, share, and subscribe button. Also, go to altscon.com. We are hosting one of the largest alternative conferences, specifically around tax-advantaged investing and alternative asset classes in October. So we'd love to have you there as well. But until next week, thanks for being here and happy investing.
Jason, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Justin.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope the information within this podcast has given you the tools that you need to find your way to financial independence. We would love to partner with you on this journey. Text ALTS, that's ALTS, to 407-708-1853 to learn more about how to get started today. Don't forget to follow us to make sure you don't miss a second of content, and we'll see you next week.